Usually, when we talk about a medical diagnosis, there's this expectation of precision,
Right.
right? It feels almost like engineering. You know, you break your arm, the x-ray shows that jagged white line, and the doctor just points and says, "There it is, that's the problem."
Right, broken or not broken is a very clean binary reality.
Exactly. But when you step into the incredibly complex ecosystem of global health financing, well, that x-ray machine is fundamentally broken.
Yeah, we're looking at a diagnostic landscape that is entirely murky right now.
And today, Friday, June 12, 2026, we are taking a deep dive into a profoundly murky yet critically important shift in that landscape. We're unpacking a staggering stack of sources today for you.
Oh, yeah. We have peer-reviewed research from The Lancet, Nature, and PLOS Medicine, plus real-time, on-the-ground reporting from Reuters, DeVex, and the Associated Press.
And all of this literature is converging on one single event, which is the sweeping cuts to U.S. foreign aid enacted by the Trump administration throughout 2025 and earlier this year.
The sheer volume of data coming out of the medical and humanitarian communities right now is, well, it's overwhelming. I mean, we're looking at the sudden reorganization of a global architecture that took decades to build.
Right. And before we get into the actual nuts and bolts of that reorganization, we do need to set some ground rules for our discussion today. This policy shift, which is driven by the administration's budget, is obviously politically complex. It's highly sensitive.
Definitely.
But for you listening today, we are setting the politics aside entirely. We aren't here to endorse a political viewpoint, and we're not here to critique the underlying philosophy of the administration's budget.
Right. Our mission is strictly empirical. We're here to impartially report the data, follow the math, and just convey the factual human mortality projections contained in the original source material.
Exactly. We're looking at what happens to global health, the fight against HIV/AIDS, and maternal and child survival when the financial foundation just shifts. So let's unpack this.
And, you know, for a visual representation of what we're dealing with, the backdrop behind us has just changed. It's an intricate, interconnected web of global supply chains.
Oh, wow. Yeah. Overlaid with medical charts and demographic maps.
Yeah, it resembles this glowing nervous system spanning the entire globe.
I love that visual because it grounds the conversation for you. This isn't just about abstract spreadsheets, you know, or line items on a PDF in Washington. It's about translating those policy decisions into projected heartbeats.
Absolutely.
So, to understand those projections, we first have to wrap our heads around the mechanics of the financial withdrawal itself. The reporting from DeVex points to a $30 billion slash to foreign aid accounts.
Which is just a staggering figure.
It includes development assistance, humanitarian aid, global health programs, food assistance. I mean, $30 billion is a number so big it almost loses its meaning. How does a reduction of that scale actually materialize on the ground?
Well, to understand the impact, we really need to clarify what the United States Agency for International Development, or USAID, actually does,
Right.
because they're the primary distributor of civilian foreign aid for the U.S. government. But they don't just hand over suitcases of cash to foreign governments.
That's a big misconception, right?
Exactly. What they do is issue highly specific contracts and grants to thousands of non-governmental organizations or NGOs, local health ministries, and private contractors. Basically, they fund the literal logistics of global health.
So they are essentially like the general contractor for a vast network of global humanitarian subcontractors.
That is a highly effective way to think about it. And according to The Guardian, the administration terminated about 83% of USAID programs following a rapid 6-week purge.
Wait, 83%.
Yeah, 83%. They reviewed the agency's portfolio, halted the vast majority of its operations, and initiated a transfer of the remaining programs to the State Department.
A 6-week purge for an agency operating in over 100 countries. And that sounds less like a strategic reorganization and more like pulling the emergency brake on a speeding freight train.
That's a great analogy.
You can't just expect the cargo to sit perfectly still. The momentum of the system is too great, and the sudden stop is going to cause a violent derailment.
And the derailment was immediate. I mean, DeVex and the new humanitarian tracked the operational fallout on the ground. We saw instant furloughs, administrative leave, and stop work orders issued to those thousands of subcontractors
Right away.
right away. Major organizations like the International Rescue Committee were forced into emergency layoff planning. The Danish Refugee Council actually announced the emergency termination of around 2,000 staff members almost overnight.
2,000 people. But hold on, let me trace the logic here for a second. If the money for these programs was already appropriated by Congress in previous years, how does firing the staff stop the shipment of goods?
Ah, that's the crucial part.
Because the Associated Press and Reuters both reported this warning from the USAID Inspector General about $8.2 billion in unspent humanitarian assistance. And it was left in this state of severely reduced oversight. If the money was there, why couldn't the aid just keep flowing?
Because the bureaucracy is the delivery mechanism.
Okay, what do you mean by that?
You cannot move temperature-controlled vaccines across rural sub-Saharan Africa without the logistical coordinators who map the routes. You need the accountants who authorize the fuel payments. You need the compliance officers who ensure the aid isn't being diverted by local militias.
Right, the plumbing of the whole system.
Exactly. When you furlough the administrative personnel, the legal authority to move those goods evaporates. So the watchdog warned of severe risks that this unspent aid could be wasted, delayed, or spoiled.
Oh, wow.
We are talking about literal tons of food sitting in shipping containers at ports and essential medicines expiring in warehouses simply because the personnel authorized to release them no longer had jobs.
And the State Department couldn't just step in and sign the forms.
Well, no. The State Department is fundamentally a diplomatic entity. They're not a global logistics and supply chain operator. Asking them to suddenly absorb and manage the granular daily operations of thousands of active humanitarian contracts worldwide within a six-week window is an impossible administrative burden.
So the plumbing of foreign aid burst because the technical workers maintaining it were just removed.
Exactly.
Let's talk about those technical workers, because you mentioned 2,000 laid off staff at just one organization, the Danish Refugee Council. What happens to the institutional memory of these NGOs when highly specialized workers just vanish from the field?
That knowledge evaporation is one of the most insidious long-term consequences of all this.
Really?
Yeah. Think about a logistics expert who has spent a decade learning how to navigate the fractured road networks, seasonal flooding, and local political rivalries in South Sudan. They carry knowledge that cannot be found in a manual.
Right, you can't just Google that.
You can't. So when that person is laid off, the institutional memory of how to keep people alive in that specific geography is just erased. Several sources warn that this degrades the world's ability to respond to future, entirely unrelated crises.
Because the network isn't there anymore.
Right. If an earthquake hits a vulnerable region tomorrow, the networks and personnel required to deploy an emergency medical response are fundamentally hollowed out.
Wow. Yeah. So if the collapse of the logistical plumbing shows us the operational reality, the downstream effect is the actual human toll. And this is where we get into those medical models projecting future fatalities.
Yes, the models.
The primary study anchoring much of our source material today comes from researchers at UCLA. It was published in The Lancet. They conducted a retrospective impact evaluation paired with a forecasting analysis.
Right. So first, they established the baseline of what was lost. They estimated that between 2001 and 2021, USAID-supported programs helped prevent an estimated 91 million deaths in low- and middle-income countries.
Right. 91 million?
91 million.
That is more than a quarter of the entire population of the United States, saved over two decades. It's a monumental public health achievement.
It truly is. But their forecasting model for the future is devastating. They project that if the current defunding trajectory continues, more than 14 million additional preventable deaths could occur by 2030 due to the withdrawal of USAID support alone.
Just from the U.S. withdrawal?
Just the U.S.
But the United States doesn't operate in a vacuum. Because Reuters reported on this compound effect. If European governments and other major donors also scale back their official development assistance alongside the U.S., which, by the way, is a trend heavily indicated in current budget debates across Europe right now.
Yeah, it's definitely happening.
The numbers escalate drastically. A combined withdrawal could lead to up to 22.6 million excess deaths. And there's a separate modeling study in Nature that suggests we could see 25 million deaths over a 15-year period.
Right, and the variance in those numbers depends on the severity of the secondary withdrawals from other nations, obviously. But the baseline consensus across all the peer-reviewed models is a staggering regression in human survival.
Let me play devil's advocate here for a second. Because when you hear numbers like 14 million, 22 million, 25 million, the human brain struggles to process them.
It's hard to visualize, yeah.
It is very easy to file those figures under, you know, worst-case scenario mathematical models running on a computer. Are these just theoretical academic exercises, or are we actively seeing the grim reality on the ground right now a year into this freeze?
That is the essential question. The models are mathematical, yes, but they are built on highly reliable empirical realities. The Center for Global Development recently updated their estimates, and they rely on a very strict causal chain. Reduced funding directly equals fewer services. Fewer services directly equal untreated disease. What's fascinating here is how epidemiologists actually calculate a prevented death using historical aid data.
Yeah, walk us through the actual mechanics of that epidemiological modeling. How do they calculate an excess death without just, well, guessing?
It relies on historical cost per intervention data. Epidemiologists know exactly how much it costs to procure and distribute a course of anti-malarial medication or a round of childhood vaccines in a specific region.
Canada the penny problem.
Exactly. And they also have decades of baseline data on local infection rates and mortality rates. So when $100 million is abruptly cut from a specific malaria program, the modelers aren't guessing.
They just do the math.
Right. They calculate precisely how many insecticide-treated bed nets will no longer be purchased, how many expected infections will subsequently occur in that unprotected population, and what percentage of those newly infected individuals will die because the medication to treat them was also defunded. It is a brutal, unyielding arithmetic.
And we are seeing the physical manifestation of that arithmetic right now. I mean, Physicians for Human Rights published this devastating brief on the localized impact in Ethiopia, specifically in the Tigray region.
Yeah, that report was tough to read.
Within weeks of the funding cuts, physical clinics simply shuttered. The most immediate reality was the total loss of post-rape care. In conflict zones, sexual violence is tragically common, and USA had funded specialized care centers. When the freeze happened, those centers closed.
Just immediately gone.
Women and girls suddenly had nowhere to go for emergency contraception, trauma counseling, or HIV prophylaxis.
And the closure of those localized clinics also triggered a secondary crisis that the report highlighted, which is that routine disease monitoring halted entirely.
Why is routine monitoring so critical, though? Can't we just treat diseases when people show up at the hospital?
Well, if you aren't monitoring at the community level, you're flying blind until the situation is catastrophic. Health officials rely on rural clinic data to detect the early whispers of an outbreak.
Like tracking the very first cases.
Right. If the health workers responsible for logging local data are laid off, a cluster of 5 cholera cases in a remote village can silently spread. It becomes 500 cases and then 5,000 before anyone at the National Health Ministry even realizes an outbreak is occurring.
Wow.
The cuts don't just stop the treatment. They deliberately blind the entire public health early warning system.
That is terrifying. A blind health system is a defenseless health system. And while those broad multi-million death projections represent dozens of different diseases across multiple continents, our sources show one of the most immediate regressions happening in a highly specific, historically vulnerable area.
HIV/AIDS.
Exactly. The fight against HIV/AIDS.
This is perhaps the most heavily documented area of acute concern in our source stack today. For over 2 decades, the United States has been the dominant force in global HIV funding through PEPFAR, the President's Emergency Plan for AIDS Relief.
Launched back in 2003, right?
Yep, 2003. And it's widely considered one of the most successful global health initiatives in history. But the recent funding freeze hit PEPFAR incredibly hard.
And the numbers projecting the fallout are so grim. A study in The Lancet HIV modeled the impact of these international funding cuts and projected up to 2.9 million additional HIV-related deaths by 2030 in low- and middle-income countries.
Just a tragic reversal of progress.
And we have fresh data on this from UNAIDS, published by Reuters literally just today. They're reporting sharp, immediate declines in HIV prevention services across high-burden countries. We're seeing major drops in access to pre-exposure prophylaxis, the daily pill that prevents infection, as well as severe disruptions in testing and condom distribution.
To understand why a disruption in HIV funding is so uniquely dangerous, we have to look at the biology of the virus and the nature of the treatment itself.
Right. Let's make an analogy for you listening. If you're taking a course of antibiotics for a sinus infection and you miss a day, you know, it's not ideal, but you generally recover. If the pharmacy runs out, you find another antibiotic. But antiretroviral therapy for HIV is not a 10-day prescription. It is a lifelong, unyielding biological commitment. A pause in medication isn't just a scheduling delay, it's a biological disaster.
Exactly. HIV is a retrovirus that integrates into the host's DNA. Antiretroviral therapy, or ART, works by suppressing the virus, keeping the viral load in the patient's blood so incredibly low that it becomes undetectable by standard tests.
And when it's undetectable?
When the virus is undetectable, the patient's immune system functions normally, and crucially, they cannot transmit the virus to anyone else. Undetectable equals untransmittable.
But what happens the moment you interrupt that daily medication because the local clinic ran out of pills?
The virus rebounds rapidly. Within weeks of stopping ART, the viral load spikes. The patient's immune system begins to fail, accelerating their progression toward AIDS, and they become highly infectious again, driving new community transmission.
So it's not just a danger to the individual, it's a danger to the community.
Exactly. Furthermore, exposing the virus to intermittent medications, stopping and starting a supply chain sputter, is the exact recipe for creating drug-resistant strains of HIV. The virus mutates to survive the inconsistent drug presence, rendering the inexpensive first-line medications entirely useless.
A study in clinical medicine focused specifically on this dynamic of temporary interruption. They modeled the PEPFAR funding freeze in 7 sub-Saharan African countries and found that even brief interruptions, just a few months of stockouts, resulted in measurable, permanent excess deaths and thousands of new infections. You simply cannot put a retrovirus on pause while politicians debate a budget.
You really can't. And the reality of these stockouts is often more insidious than a completely empty pharmacy shelf. The VEX sent reporters to Uganda, Zambia, Malawi, and Botswana a year after the freeze began to observe the ground truth.
What did they find?
What they found was that in some major hospitals, the physical pills were still there, running on a pre-existing stockpile, but the entire infrastructure built around dispensing those pills had collapsed.
What does the infrastructure around the pills actually look like? Because I just picture a doctor handing over a bottle.
Keeping someone on lifelong medication in a rural, low-resource setting requires a vast, invisible net of community support. You need community health workers who physically follow up when a patient misses an appointment.
Like actually going to their house.
Yes. You need targeted outreach programs that go into marginalized communities to offer testing. You need specialized transport systems like motorcycle couriers to get blood samples from a rural village to a central lab to monitor a patient's viral load.
Wow.
All of that peripheral vital community infrastructure was funded by USAID, and all of it was dismantled.
So the pills might physically exist in a box in the capital city, but the system that ensures a patient 20 miles away is tested, diagnosed, connected to care, and retained in that care is just gone.
Precisely. And without that retention infrastructure, patients fall out of care. The Guardian published a piece explicitly warning that this exact scenario could trigger a completely new epidemic.
A completely new one.
Yeah. They noted that these severe funding cuts are happening concurrently with a rise in repressive laws across several nations, targeting marginalized groups, LGBTQ plus populations, sex workers, and people who inject drugs.
Oh, man.
When you combine severe health infrastructure defunding with laws that actively drive vulnerable people away from whatever fragmented health services remain, you create the perfect incubator for a massive resurgence of the virus.
It's just a perfect storm. If the collapse of chronic care for HIV shows us what happens when supply chains freeze over months, the impact on our next demographic shows us the lethal consequences of a freeze measured in minutes.
Yes.
We're looking at the most vulnerable populations affected by the rollback of medical infrastructure, mothers and young children.
The data here is incredibly stark. A study published in Health Policy and Planning looked at the projected impact on 6 specific African countries: Burkina Faso, Central African Republic, Chad, Mali, Niger, and Nigeria.
A region already facing immense developmental and security challenges.
Right. And the researchers modeled a no-substitution scenario, which means they calculated the outcomes if U.S. funding vanishes and no other international donor steps in to fill the gap.
And their projection was a 45% increase in maternal deaths among populations in humanitarian need across the 6 countries, a 45% spike in mothers dying during or shortly after childbirth. Why is maternal health so uniquely vulnerable to these specific funding shocks?
Because safe childbirth isn't something you can schedule around a disrupted supply chain.
Right. Babies come when they come.
Exactly. It requires a health system to be in a state of absolute readiness 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. Mm-hmm. It requires trained birth attendants who can instantly recognize life-threatening complications. Most importantly, it requires emergency obstetric care.
Like if something goes wrong during delivery.
Yes. If a woman experiences postpartum hemorrhage, severe uncontrolled bleeding after birth, or eclampsia, she needs immediate specialized medical intervention.
She needs a facility with sterile supplies, electricity, safe blood transfusions, the drug oxytocin to stop the bleeding, and reliable transportation to actually reach that facility from her home.
And USAID was funding the connective tissue of all those requirements, from paying for the specialized training of the midwives, to purchasing and maintaining the ambulances, to stocking the sterile gloves and the oxytocin.
So when you abruptly pull that funding,
the physical clinic building might technically stay open, sure, but the ambulance has no fuel, the pharmacy shelves are bare, and the midwife hasn't received a salary in months. The inevitable result of that systemic hollowing out is a 45% spike in maternal mortality.
And the statistics regarding children are even harder to process. The Oxfam analysis looked at the projected aid cut mortality estimates and concluded that by 2030, U.S. aid cuts could result in a child under 5 dying every 40 seconds.
Every 40 seconds. It is an agonizing metric. And a major driver of this specific mortality rate is the withdrawal of support for Gavi, the Vaccine Alliance.
Let's explain what Gavi actually is for you listening, because it's crucial to understanding this crisis. Gavi is an international public-private partnership that pools the demand for vaccines from the world's poorest countries.
Right.
By guaranteeing a massive market for pharmaceutical companies, Gavi drives down the price of life-saving vaccines to a fraction of their commercial cost, and then helps distribute them to countries that could never afford them otherwise. And the U.S. was historically one of the primary sovereign backers of Gavi.
Which is why the MSF Access campaign, the policy arm of Doctors Without Borders, issued a severe warning that the withdrawal of U.S. support puts millions of children's lives at direct risk.
Here's where this gets deeply, deeply frustrating. We aren't talking about million-dollar experimental gene therapies or cutting-edge oncology drugs. Here's where it gets really interesting. We are talking about the most cost-effective, thoroughly proven interventions in the history of medicine.
Routine vaccines.
Yes, routine vaccines for measles, pneumonia, and diphtheria. These vaccines cost pennies, or at most a few dollars, per dose. They yield the highest survival rates of almost any medical intervention we have. Defunding them is particularly tragic because it's not a question of scientific limitation. We know exactly how to cure these diseases.
It's purely a question of financing.
Exactly. When a child dies of measles in 2026, it is solely because the financial supply chain that brought the vaccine to their village was severed.
And the vulnerability of these children is compounded by the collapse of nutritional support. UNICEF put out data warning that 14 million children faced disruptions to critical nutrition services in 2025 alone.
14 million.
Yeah. Nutrition is the absolute foundation of child survival, and USAID was a central pillar in funding it.
How does that disruption link directly to the mortality projections, though?
Well, UNICEF differentiates between stunting, which is chronic malnutrition that impairs long-term growth and brain development, and wasting, which is severe, acute malnutrition, where a child's weight drops to immediately life-threatening levels.
And USAID was helping with the wasting.
Heavily. USAID heavily funded the procurement and distribution of therapeutic foods like Plumpy Nut, which is a highly fortified, calorie-dense peanut paste in a foil packet used to treat severe wasting. It can literally bring a starving child back from the brink of death in a matter of days.
But when the funding for that specific supply chain is cut, children facing severe wasting lose their only buffer. And severe malnutrition effectively destroys a child's immune system.
Right.
So a child who misses their therapeutic nutrition support is vastly more likely to die if they catch the measles that they couldn't get vaccinated against. It is an intersecting web of biological vulnerabilities.
And the tragedy doesn't stop at the biology. When preventable diseases surge through a population, they bring devastating economic consequences for the families left behind. This brings us to a fascinating, albeit grim, area of study regarding tuberculosis and the cycle of poverty.
Tuberculosis, or TB, provides a perfect lens through which to view this secondary economic devastation. According to the World Health Organization, TB control relies almost entirely on two pillars: rapid diagnostics and strict treatment continuity.
Very similar to HIV in that regard.
Right. Historically, TB programs in low- and middle-income countries have been heavily dependent on external donor financing, primarily from USAID and the Global Fund.
The Global Fund is another massive international financing partnership, similar to Gavi, but focused specifically on ending AIDS, tuberculosis, and malaria. The U.S. has historically been its largest contributor.
And when that funding drops?
When that funding drops, the PLOS medicine study in our sources provides a brilliant analysis of the fallout. The first thing to collapse is screening and diagnostics. People presenting with chronic coughs are turned away or misdiagnosed because the local clinic can no longer afford to run the specialized laboratory tests.
Which means those undiagnosed individuals return to their crowded homes, multi-generational households, and dense workplaces, actively spreading an airborne disease.
Exactly. The feedback loop begins. Fewer screenings mean higher community transmission. And if someone is lucky enough to get diagnosed, but the clinic runs out of medication halfway through their rigorous 6 to 9 month treatment regimen, the TB bacteria mutates,
creating a resistant strain.
Yes. This creates multi-drug resistant TB, or MDR-TB. Treating MDR-TB takes up to 2 years, involves medications with horrific side effects, and is exponentially more expensive for the health system.
But the PLOS Medicine study went beyond just the clinical outcomes, right?
So, yeah.
They focused heavily on the household economic burden.
They did.
They modeled how donor funding reductions increase catastrophic costs for families. Because when the free, donor-funded public clinic in a village closes, the disease doesn't magically disappear. The patient still gets desperately sick.
Right. Imagine you are living paycheck to paycheck, working in an informal economy where if you don't work today, you don't eat today. Suddenly, the free clinic in your village shuts down due to aid cuts. You develop a severe, racking cough. You are coughing up blood and losing weight. You now face an impossible choice. You either stay home and deteriorate, or you undertake a full day's travel on expensive transport to reach a paid private clinic in the city.
I mean, put yourself in that position. Imagine you're already living paycheck to paycheck, and you have to choose between a full day's travel to a paid clinic or feeding your family.
It's an impossible choice, and the PLOS Medicine study demonstrates that families will systematically drain their life savings to make that trip. They will sell their livestock, their farming tools, or their land to pay for private care and transportation.
Sacrificing their future livelihood.
Yeah. They immediately lose the income of the sick person, and they simultaneously lose the income of the healthy family member who has to stay home to provide care. The study maps out exactly how this creates a catastrophic financial ruin for the household. It is a vicious cycle where the illness worsens the poverty, and the deepening poverty makes it impossible to treat the illness. If we connect this to the bigger picture, this localized household poverty leads right back to national destabilization, when hundreds of thousands of families in a single country suddenly fall into extreme, irrecoverable poverty because they are paying out of pocket for TB care or burying a primary earner, the national economy shudders. You see a shrinking workforce, plummeting consumer spending, and rapidly widening inequality.
Your point about national destabilization perfectly cues us to look beyond the medical clinics entirely, because the societal shockwaves of this aid withdrawal touch every facet of civil society. Let's look at the broader ripple effects: hunger, education, and ultimately conflict.
The medical models we've discussed exist within highly complex societies. Let's start with food security. The sources paint a grim picture of compounding crises where natural disasters intersect with the sudden absence of aid.
Like what's happening in Somalia.
Exactly. The Guardian reports on Somalia, a nation facing a worsening hunger crisis driven by brutal climate change, severe, prolonged droughts, followed by intense, destructive floods. But a climate shock only turns into a famine when the humanitarian safety net is absent.
Because the U.S. funding that would normally supply emergency grain shipments or fund direct cash transfers to farmers during a drought has been zeroed out.
Precisely. And DivX reported on Nepal, a country that had spent a decade making steady, measurable gains in child nutrition gains, meticulously built using U.S.-funded community agricultural programs.
And those gains?
Those gains are vanishing overnight. In Syrian displacement camps, on-the-ground reports show food lines literally halting and vital bread distribution programs stopping within weeks of the U.S.-side freeze. It is a total systemic shock to global food security.
And what happens to the children in those communities? UNICEF released projections stating that 6 million additional children could be forced out of school by the end of 2026 directly due to global funding cuts. 6 million kids? How does that line draw so cleanly from a foreign aid budget to a local classroom?
Well, in many humanitarian and crisis settings, schools are not just educational facilities. They are vital, multi-purpose survival hubs. A school funded by humanitarian aid provides a daily hot meal, which might be the only nutrition that child receives.
That makes sense.
It provides physical safety and adult supervision. It provides routine and psychosocial support for children who have fled war zones or natural disasters.
So when the funding stops, the school closes, the meal disappears, and the physical safety net vanishes.
And those children are immediately pushed out onto the streets or into dangerous informal labor. they become highly vulnerable to exploitation, trafficking, or early forced marriage. The collapse of the educational infrastructure feeds directly into the collapse of societal stability.
Which brings us to perhaps the most alarming non-medical finding in our source stack, the May 2026 study published in the journal Science.
Oh, this is a phenomenal piece of research that connects the dots between budget cuts and geopolitics. The Science study analyzed the effect of the abrupt USAID cuts on subnational regions across Africa.
Subnational meaning specific local areas.
Right. The researchers didn't just look at national averages, they mapped out exactly which specific towns and provinces had been historically highly dependent on USAID support. Then they tracked the geopolitical events in those specific microregions in the months immediately following the shutdown.
And what did the data show?
They found a sharp, statistically significant increase in violence, armed clashes, protests, and riots specifically concentrated in the exact areas that had suddenly lost their aid.
Wait, really? So what does this all mean for global security? Are we saying that a canceled food grant in one country directly fuels an armed insurgency? I mean, that sounds like a leap.
It sounds like a leap until you look at the raw mechanics of resource scarcity and localized economies. The researchers explain the correlation very clearly. When you abruptly withdraw tens of millions of dollars of aid from a fragile developing region, you aren't just removing bags of grain or boxes of pills. You are removing the region's primary economic engine. You are instantly creating desperate resource scarcity.
The New Humanitarian provided an incredibly clear example of this dynamic in northeast Nigeria, specifically in the city of Maiduguri. Maiduguri has been the epicenter of the conflict with the armed insurgency group Boko Haram. Over the years, this massive humanitarian economy had built up around the USAID presence there.
Let's define what a humanitarian economy looks like on the ground. It means that local Nigerian businesses are contracted to supply the NGOs with building materials and office supplies. Local landlords rent out secure compounds to aid groups.
Right.
Most importantly, thousands of local citizens are employed directly as drivers, translators, logistics coordinators, warehouse managers, and security personnel.
So when the USAID cuts hit, that local economy was instantly paralyzed. Thousands of young men suddenly lose their reliable, well-paying jobs with the aid agencies. At the exact same time, you remove the food and health support for the victims of the conflict in the surrounding displacement camps, drastically worsening the overall survival conditions.
And who thrives in an environment of extreme, sudden poverty, high youth unemployment, and governmental collapse? Armed groups. Insurgencies like Boko Haram actively exploit those exact conditions. They recruit young people who suddenly have no other way to feed their families, offering them purpose, resources, and a salary. The sudden withdrawal of aid acts as a direct accelerant for geopolitical instability and armed conflict.
This overwhelming web of dependency, where an entire city's economy is floating on foreign aid, or millions of lives depend on a single donor, brings up a profound ethical question about the nature of foreign assistance itself. The Lancet published a fascinating commentary looking at this entire crisis through the framework of legitimate expectations.
This raises an important question. The legal and ethical concept of legitimate expectations asks a very difficult question. If a wealthy donor country comes into a low-income country, sets up a nationwide network of HIV clinics, funds them continuously for 20 years, and actively encourages millions of citizens to rely on them for daily survival, does that donor have an ethical obligation to maintain that support?
Or, at the very least, an obligation to provide a responsible, phased exit strategy.
Exactly. It questions the ethics of the international aid architecture that allowed such severe dependency to form in the first place.
It's essentially the you break it, you buy it rule, but applying to international public health infrastructure. It highlights the problem of extreme donor dependency. The global South's reliance on a few major Western donors is the defining feature of the current global health architecture. It is a dependency trap.
A trap that was built over decades.
Yeah. The system was designed in a way that centralized the funding and decision-making power in places like Washington, London, and Geneva, while centralizing the operational reliance and the lethal consequences in places like Kampala, Port-au-Prince, and Dhaka.
And the sudden withdrawal exposes the fragility of that design.
It's a brutal paradox. Think of it like this. If you build a bridge for a community and maintain it for 20 years, the community builds its entire economy around that bridge. Markets move closer to it. People take jobs on the other side of the river because they know they can cross it every morning.
Right, they rely on it.
If you blow it up overnight, you can't just say, well, you should have learned to build your own bridges. The reliance was by design.
And when the bridge blows up, the immediate question is, why can't someone else just rebuild it? The sources show us attempts at substitution. When the U.S. funding vanished, Nigerian lawmakers, for example, approved $200 million in emergency domestic funding to try and offset the health aid shortfall.
Okay, that's something.
And in the philanthropic sector, organizations like GiveWell are attempting to rapidly plug the gaps, redirecting private donor money to urgent, highly effective needs like malaria prevention.
But is it enough? Can a middle-income country like Nigeria or a well-funded charity just step in and replace the financial footprint of the United States government?
A comprehensive analysis by KFF, the Kaiser Family Foundation, proves that they absolutely cannot. The math simply does not work. Other donor nations or domestic governments in the global south lack the massive fiscal space required to absorb a multi-billion-dollar gap overnight. A $200 million appropriation by Nigeria is commendable and vital, but it is a fraction of what was lost in the $30 billion slash.
And what about the billionaires? I mean, can philanthropy scale up?
Philanthropy is incredibly agile and vital, but it cannot scale to replace state-level sovereign funding. Private foundations cannot fund the entire public health infrastructure of a continent indefinitely. The fiscal capacity of a sovereign nation like the United States is entirely unmatched by private wealth.
This raises an incredibly important point for you listening. Think about what true responsibility looks like in geopolitics. Is it staying forever, or is it ensuring a soft landing? How did the global community allow a system to develop where the survival of 14 million people rests entirely on the outcome of a single election cycle or a single budget debate in a capital city thousands of miles away?
It's a sobering realization.
The ethics of allowing such severe dependency to form in the first place are deeply questionable, but the consequences of abruptly severing that dependency are lethal.
And as the modeling studies from UCLA and The Lancet continually remind us, those consequences are not theoretical debates. They are unfolding right now, in real time, across thousands of clinics and communities.
Let's synthesize everything we've unpacked today. We started by looking at the operational chaos of a $30 billion defunding event. We saw how firing the logistical staff paralyzed the delivery of $8 billion in unspent aid.
The logistics collapse.
Right. Then we looked at the profound mortality projections. 14 to 25 million preventable deaths by 2030. We saw how abruptly stopping chronic care for HIV creates drug-resistant mutations and threatens a devastating resurgence of the virus. We examined the 45% spike in maternal mortality and the heartbreaking, entirely preventable reality of a child dying every 40 seconds due to defunded vaccines and nutrition programs.
We also mapped the economic ruin of tuberculosis, showing how families drain their life savings and how that localized loss of aid ripples outward to cause regional hunger, force millions of children out of school, and actively accelerate armed conflict by creating sudden resource scarcity.
The numbers are staggering. The geopolitical destabilization is documented and real. But behind every single data point from these sources is a human being. A mother in Burkina Faso hoping the clinic has oxytocin. A young man working as a driver in Maiduguri who suddenly can't feed his family. A child in Nepal whose nutritional support vanished overnight.
It is the ultimate diagnostic challenge of our time. The systemic failure is vast.
It truly is. And as we close this deep dive, I want to leave you with a new, lingering concept to mull over, something we haven't explicitly discussed yet, but that builds directly on the ashes of this dependency trap.
A potential long-term shift born from this immediate crisis.
Exactly. If the withdrawal of Western donor funding proves to be a permanent reality, if the U.S. and Europe never return to their previous levels of global aid, could this catastrophic shock ultimately force the global south to build a completely new, sovereign, and self-reliant global health architecture?
That's a fascinating thought.
In 20 years, when we look back at this tragic withdrawal of aid, not just as a period of profound human loss, but as the painful forced birth of a decentralized global health system where the West is no longer the savior.
A system built on domestic taxation, regional African and Asian alliances, and sovereign pharmaceutical manufacturing, rather than relying on the fragile political whims of a foreign capital.
Precisely. It is a terrible, agonizing price to pay. But it might be the only path to true independence and systemic resilience. Thank you for joining us on this deep dive. Keep asking the hard questions. Because when you step into the world of global health, that simple, clean X-ray machine is broken. The picture is messy, the stakes are literal life and death, and the responsibility to understand it belongs to all of us.